I can. I'm sorry.
Iden.
Okay. Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Oh, I just asked for the pronunciation of the last name. It's Iden.
I see Charlie. You're correct. He's here.
Oh,
you
great.
See Charlie's back there?
Oh, where?
With Dan Pulsenberg.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The conference, they said, everybody stand up and like, raise your arms and sense bless your head and so you're
do you think I actually,
better.
I might.
Yeah, go.
Okay, go.
Just getting back. Okay.
Nobody else gets to hear the right.
The Court of Appeals is back in session.
I will now call our next case. This is the time and date set for oral argument in case number 88496 in the matter of Smith versus Iden. At council table, we have attorney David Snyder for appellant Ashley Smith and Caleb Meyer on behalf of respondent Daniel Iden. And I don't know if anyone else is with at council table, but perhaps Mr. Snyder, you could.
Mr. Eccles, also with Claggett and Sexton.
Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Each side is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Mr. Snyder, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
4 minutes, please.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Judge Bulla, Judge Gibbons, and Judge Westbrook. David Snyder on behalf of the appellant, Ashley Smith. May it please the court. The civil jury system is a cornerstone of democratic governance and the social contract. The judge representing the state resolves legal questions. The jury representing the citizenry resolves factual questions. This power-sharing system, as John Locke recognized, protects natural rights and promotes impartial accountability. Justice results when both faithfully discharge their duties. Our reverence for the system doesn't just exist in treatises in the law library, however. Our jurisprudence itself reflects this reverence, giving great deference to a jury's findings and imposing arduous standards before a court may disturb them. Here, appellant Ashley Smith demanded a civil jury trial. She prosecuted her claims before a jury of Nevada citizens. She obtained a unanimous $775,000 pain and suffering damages award to compensate her for the 680 days that she lived with a torn rotator cuff in her dominant arm. Rather than give the jury's verdict the deference that our jurisprudence demands, the district court assumed juror confusion, sua sponte raised arguments on Iden's behalf, conjured evidence that doesn't exist, reweighed the evidence, displaced the jury's judgment with its own, and misapplied the NRCP 59A1E standards, ordering a new trial on pain and suffering damages unless Ashley forfeit $430,000 of her recovery. There is no cogent argument supporting the district court's award, and this court should forcefully reverse. As a threshold matter, Iden waived his NRCP 59A1E contention. As the per curiam court held in Kramer versus Peavy, a movement seeking NRCP 59A1E relief must object to the jury's verdict before the district court discharges them.
But Mr. Snyder, you all did not raise that argument below, did you?
Iden conceded in his answering brief, argument section 1A on page 11, that we preserve these arguments for appeal. And I think that that would resolve your question, Judge Bulla. But even if this court were to overlook Iden's concession, the district court's order nonetheless fails on substantive grounds, which I'm happy to address now. NRCP 59A1 relief is only available if the jury's verdict is impossible, given the district court's instructions. And as the per curiam court noted in Town and Country Electric versus Hawk, Nevada courts strictly construe this rule. In resolving such a motion, district courts are supposed to follow several standards. First, is the court is supposed to presume that the jurors followed the court's instructions. Justice Rehnquist, writing in Parker versus Randolph, noted that this assumption is crucial to the jury system itself. A contrary rule would render the court's instructions meaningless and reversal for failure to follow them unworkable. Justice Pickering, writing in Cox versus Copperfield, noted that we follow this rule. We presume that jurors follow instructions and we uphold the jury's verdict if a reasonable mind might accept the evidence as adequate to support a conclusion. The at-issue instruction here, jury instruction 24, provided in relevant part that the argument of counsel as to the amount of damages is not evidence of reasonable compensation. During closing, Ashley requested $729,000 in pain and suffering damages. During deliberations, the jury asked if the $729,000 that Ashley asked for was set in stone or if it can change. The district court directed the jury back to the instructions on damages. The jury returned with a unanimous $775,000 pain and suffering damages award. The jury clearly understood the instruction because it returned a different award. The entire premise that Iden moved for a new trial on in the district court, that the jury awarded exactly what Ashley requested, is false, and it always has been. Rather than summarily reject this false argument, the district court sua sponte deemed that an award that is close enough or substantially similar would be good enough to trigger her belief that this jury was confused. However, Justice Young writing in Leonard versus State and Justice Mabry writing in Guy versus State both held that demonstrating juror confusion requires evidence, not speculation. Now, Nevada's appellate courts haven't addressed yet what might constitute evidence of juror confusion, but other courts have. In Isho EY versus Occidental Crude Sales, the Fifth Circuit noted that such evidence might constitute an express admission by the juror's foreman upon the district court's questioning, coupled with an impossible verdict. However, as the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania noted in Bayren versus Kelly, a juror's question to the court during deliberations alone does not constitute evidence of juror confusion when the jury's verdict is nonetheless possible under the circumstances.
I have a question. So yes, instruction number 24 uses the word reasonable 5 different times when referring to permissible damages. Could the district court's order be viewed as a finding that the verdict was impossible if the jury had only been reasonable?
I don't think that it can under the circumstances. And I think the reason here is because the district court's own order admits that if it considers Ashley's evidence that the jury's pain and suffering award was possible, the court will find this in volume 11, page 2372 through 73. And district court included that in its order for good reason. Ashley's own testimony, her sister Caitlin Wright's testimony, her father Derek Smith's testimony, her chiropractic records from Dr. Heitz, her pain management records from Dr. Rossler, her orthopedic records from Dr. Liu and from Dr. Amos, and her physical therapy records from Mr. Klossman all demonstrate that Ashley lived with pain and impairment for 680 days between when this collision occurred and when she recovered from rotator cuff surgery. That should have foreclosed the district court's analysis. Once again, the test for relief for manifest disregard of the jury instructions is whether the jury's verdict is possible. And if it is, you must reject relief under this ground. Had the district court correctly applied the governing legal standard here, it would have ended its inquiry.
Well, and Mr. Snyder, you're not saying that the court shouldn't have reviewed the evidence. In other words, what is the line of demarcation between a district court properly reviewing evidence and improperly reweighing it when considering to grant a new trial?
That's a great question, and I think our case law distills this readily. Reese versus Rodriguez, I think, is a good case there. The Supreme Court of Nevada addressed a case where it was a professional negligence case resulting in amputation. Both parties' experts testified that the defendant healthcare provider fell below the standard of care and that that failure caused the amputation. Despite that uncontroverted evidence and despite the court's instructions regarding proximate cause, the jury nonetheless returned a defense verdict for the doctor. Under those circumstances, given the evidence, that verdict would have been impossible. And the Supreme Court of Nevada affirmed the district court's grant of a new trial on manifest disregard. The flip side of that, though, is district courts can't reweigh evidence where a jury's conclusion is possible. I think Town Country and Electrico versus Hawk demonstrates that. There, it was a negligence case involving a light fixture in a rental. And a light fell on a tenant's head. The fixture was missing a lock nut, but it also had stripped screws. And so when the plaintiff brought a cause of action against the persons that installed the light fixture, they returned a defense verdict, and the court's reasoning was, well, yes, the undisputed facts showed that it was missing a screw, but the jury could have found that it was actually the stripped screws that caused the fixture to fall on its head, and a former tenant could have done that. And so the question that the court asks when reviewing relief under NRCP 50A1E is this verdict possible, given the evidence? Giving all inferences in favor in the light most favorable of the verdict, and accepting the jury's factual findings if there's evidence to support them. Now, if I can just briefly return to some of the other standards that the district court, in my view, misapplied in this case. It's not just that the court was supposed to presume that the jury followed the court's instructions. It's not just that the court was also supposed to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. And here, the district court sua sponte relied on Caitlin Wright's testimony in granting relief below, claiming that she testified that my client was lazy and didn't want to work. There's no such testimony in this matter's record, and you'll find her testimony in Volume 1, pages 230 to 47. Caitlin testified that Ashley is an independent person. Now, true, Caitlin testified that she and Ashley had gotten into arguments at times when Ashley didn't work or didn't have a job, but Nevada jurisprudence didn't permit the district court to view that single sentence in her testimony and construe it in the light least favorable to Ashley. The jury heard this evidence, too. They discredited it. The district court was supposed to give that weight. In not doing so, it abused its discretion. Finally, judges are not supposed to substitute their judgment in the place of the jury's. Here, the jury found that Iden's negligence caused her injuries, and it awarded her her prior medical awards for her low back injury and for her left shoulder injury. Rather than accept these findings, the district court sua sponte wanted to reweigh the evidence that Iden proffered at trial. The problem is that Iden's evidence, through Dr. Lesnack, Dr. Massey, and Mr. Himsel, only went to causation. None of these experts proffered any evidence that controverted hers, that she experienced pain and impairment during the time that she was injured. Justice Mowbray, writing in Stackowitz versus Nissan Motor Corp, noted that pain and suffering damages fall within the jury's province. And if we borrow from the remitter case law, when the evidence does not conflict, And here, there is no conflict in the evidence that Ashley experienced pain and lived with impairment while she was injured. Then any reduction of the jury's verdict is suspect.
Hey, Mr. Snyder, when the jury asked the question about the damages and the instruction, did everyone agree, meaning all parties and the district court, as to what the response would be?
Yes. The parties agreed that they should direct them to the two instructions concerning damages, which included this one and I think a separate jury instruction.
So where does the confusion come from then?
I don't think that the jury was confused at all. I think they understood the instruction and made an award that differed than what Ashley asked for. I think the district court erred in presuming that confusion existed in the first instance because this verdict was possible under the circumstances. If I may, I may like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer.
Good afternoon, Chief Bulla and members of the court. The appellant in this case and on this appeal complicates a rather simple analysis as it relates to jury instruction and confusion as it relates to jury instruction. And specifically, the most important part of this court's analysis and review of the district court's order and its decisions in this case has to be viewed with the standard of review of abuse of discretion. And the reason why that is so important in this case is because the district court is the one who had the best opportunity to review the information, the evidence in its totality through the entirety of trial. And that is why the standard of review exists with respect to motions for new trial, is because we give great deference to the district courts when making these types of decisions and determinations. In this case, the district court correctly concluded that the record indicates juror confusion. Now, in the motion for new trial, that confusion was flushed out a little bit in several different ways. One was there was two different verdict forms. There was a defense verdict form and there was a plaintiff verdict form. The district court in that particular case suspected or believed that there was potential juror confusion.
Mr. Meyer, aren't there always two verdict forms, though, for a jury to consider? One that is a defense verdict form and one that is a plaintiff's verdict form. And the plaintiff's verdict form in this case had blanks where a jury then could insert damages if they decided to find for the plaintiff. So what is it about the existence of two forms that is troubling?
To answer your direct question, not always are there two verdict forms in a particular case. There can be a single verdict form depending on, for example, whether liability is admitted.
But you agreed to submit two jury forms to the jury.
We did in this particular case, Your Honor, and that's because we believed that given the evidence that was submitted, that the jury could potentially conclude that there were no injuries or damages that were caused by this particular incident, and therefore a defense verdict would have reflected zero award in this particular case. And so that explains why there was potentially also confusion amongst the jury. Did the jury, were they confused by the fact that could we award something less than what counsel or potentially more than what plaintiff's counsel or appellant's counsel requested, but not award zero as it relates and therefore fill out the defendant's verdict form? And so, and the court went through that analysis in the post-trial, in the Rule 59 post-trial motions, and specifically confirmed for the record that was part of the court's concern about jury confusion. And
Mr.
So,
Meyer, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make certain before we go into the jury confusion issue a little bit more, the judge also gave the alternative relief of remittitor, and that was not addressed in your answering brief. Are you conceding remitter, and are you here today just to address the affirmance of the new trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So didn't the defense request a zero verdict, as you said? Straight defense verdict. So the defense didn't ask for a number less than the plaintiff. And so it wasn't argued to the jury in closing argument. It was an all-or-nothing approach.
That's correct in terms of that's correct in terms of what the defense was advocating during closing argument and throughout the totality of the case. And that was based on...
So it wasn't, all right, we disagree with some of these experts, therefore their numbers are wrong on the medical expenses. Or we disagree on the pain and suffering because the injuries stopped 6 weeks after the accident, the effect of it. Nothing like that.
There was a dispute as it related to injury causation, but as a corollary to injury causation, there was a dispute as to damages resulting from injuries. Appellant suggests that there was that the respondent didn't contest damages in this particular case. That is not true. The damages that are sustained can only occur, or alleged damages, can only occur because of injury caused by the accident. If there is no injury from the accident, there can be no damages. So the challenge as it relates...
I understand that. Okay. That makes sense.
Did you present
any... Let me ask you one more, sorry. Okay. You said that we should defer to the district court because this is a discretionary call. Well, in the post-trial motion, the district court said there was no misconduct by plaintiff's counsel when criticizing the out-of-state defense experts. So the court said that was not a basis for a new trial. That was a discretionary call. Was that one correct?
Well, certainly the court, whether we agree with that or not, I don't think we necessarily agreed with that, but... That was a decision that was left within the discretion of the trial court. And so our agreement or disagreement with that is not relevant necessarily
right,
to...
So, but the defense chose not to appeal. So the only issue raised on appeal then relates to the jury confusion.
That's correct.
Based on the jury instruction 24.
That's correct.
So it's a very narrow issue then.
It is a narrow issue before this court, correct.
So I'm wondering how you respond to Mr. Snyder's argument that there was no evidence from the defense presented at trial that pain and suffering was less than what the plaintiff had requested. Do you agree with that representation?
No, and the reason why we disagree with it is because there was not only engineering, biomechanical evidence, there was medical evidence from a medical doctor, Dr. Lesnack. There was chiropractic evidence, chiropractic doctor evidence, all of which indicated that the plaintiff, in this case, the appellant, could not have sustained injury as a result of this accident.
Right, that's causation, though. I guess his argument, though, was that there was no evidence that took away from the testimony they presented on pain and suffering, specifically. Not causation, but the amount of suffering that she experienced, assuming the jury found causation. What evidence did you present below to counter what she testified to
sure.
about her pain and suffering?
Sure. So the record, this is in our briefs, but the record indicates that as a result of this accident, there was police weren't called. There was no emergency medical care. The plaintiff was not prescribed any type of pain medication whatsoever for months after the accident. There were delays in treatment and care that existed following the accident. And all of that coupled with the testimony from the engineer who indicated that this rear-end accident that occurred at 6 miles an hour that translated to a change in velocity of 4 miles an hour equated to activities that we all experience on a day-in, day-out basis. And so it's the culmination of the appellant's subjective presentation and clinical presentation in the medical records in the immediate days, weeks, and months that followed the accident, in conjunction with the engineering expert testimony from Mr. Himsel that indicated that the appellant could not have been injured in this case to thereafter cause pain and suffering or any type of non-economic damages.
But Mr. Meyer, how do we handle the district court's acknowledgement that the district court stated that if the plaintiff, if I just focus on the plaintiff's evidence, then the evidence would support the jury's award of past pain and suffering. How does that impact the decision in terms of whether or not the pain and suffering was in fact a possible or reasonable award?
So this is where it's really important for within the analysis of for this court to recognize and apply the deference to the trial court. And when I say that, what I mean is this. The district court did acknowledge that there was some evidence that existed or that was presented that could justify a non-economic damages award. Okay. But this is not the analysis that the court had to go through in this case with manifest disregard of the instructions is that one, it had to find that there was juror confusion, which the court did in its discretion. The court determined that there was juror confusion, and two, it thereafter then had to analyze the totality of the evidence that was presented during trial to make a decision whether or not this verdict was possible. Just because there was some evidence that's not the standard that the court had to use in this case. It had to utilize the entirety of the evidence. This was not a directed verdict standard where if there is some evidence that's presented, well then that defeats a motion for directed verdict. No, the standard that the court had to look at was the totality of the evidence in this case. And the court, in its discretion, having sat through the totality of the testimony, having viewed the witnesses, the credibility, the things that aren't necessarily on paper, but having viewed witnesses, having seen their reaction, having determined the credibility and seen the credibility of witnesses.
But the court makes the verdict impossible?
Well, certainly, the jury, to the extent that it wasn't confused, made a determination as to pain and suffering damages that existed. But so there was certainly, from the jury's perspective, that was possible. But under the analysis and the way that the court has to go through this analysis, the district court, in its discretion, concluded that no, this couldn't have been possible. At least it couldn't have been possible in the way that in the amount that the jury awarded.
How could a verdict of $725,000 on pain and suffering been possible, but not $775,000?
How could it have been possible?
Yeah, how could one be possible and the other's not?
Well,
when we know general damages are subjective, like you indicated at the outset,
sure.
And that's why we have juries to decide things like that.
We do, but in the context of juror confusion, in the context of juror confusion, the court then is obligated and is required to step into the role to make this determination about whether the verdict award, whether it's 729, whether it's 775, no matter what it is, the court then is required to make that, is to step in and make that analysis within its discretion. And in this case, the court did that viewing the totality of the information and said the 775 was not possible.
I could see that if you're adding numbers and the numbers are wrong, but I'm missing something here on general damages, how that conclusion is reached.
In terms of,
from 725 to 775, it's a judgment call. It's subjective. It's not adding up the medical expenses.
That's correct.
So how is it impossible to go from 725 to 775? We're not talking about 7 million. We're talking about 50,000 more.
The impossibility comes from the court's review of the evidence. None of us will be able to.
Does the word impossible have some meaning here that I'm missing?
Well, That is the standard. I mean, it becomes a matter of what the court, what the district court believes is a jury verdict based upon the totality of the evidence. Whether, and ultimately, the analysis gives the district court the discretion to be able to do that.
It goes to confusion, I think. I mean, that's your starting point.
Absolutely.
I mean, you have to show that there's confusion to even make this argument. And then it sounds like you agree that the whether the verdict was possible is a legitimate question to ask on appeal. And if it was possible, then, you know, it makes for a much tougher case from your perspective.
There's no doubt that the fundamental threshold that has to be met first, the first element is, was there juror confusion? And the court determined that in its discretion that there was.
Okay, so, and my question there is, what evidence do you have that the jury was confused by instruction 24 when they awarded an amount that was different from what counsel requested? As long as it was different, how were they confused, thinking that they had to award exactly what the plaintiff was asking?
Well, the court, in the court's analysis with respect to that, the court believed that there was confusion because the court believed that the jury was confused about whether it could award less than what appellant's counsel requested during closing argument, in light of the fact that there was two different, there was a defense verdict form and a plaintiff verdict form. And so that's the basis that the court in its discretion articulated in the record for why she believed that there was confusion.
So, but, okay, and I recall reading in your brief, there was reference to the defense verdict form, not the plaintiff verdict form, correct? It was the defense verdict form. If you submitted that verdict form, that problem would be created by you, right?
It would, but that's not...
So is that a basis for overturning the jury award when you injected the error into the record?
No, because I don't believe that that's relevant necessarily to confusion. It wasn't error, and we're not asserting, and nobody is asserting in this case, that it was error to submit a defense instruction as well as a plaintiff instruction. So it may have contributed to error, but there's been no argument preserved anywhere. It's never even been made or even raised that was somehow error to submit both instructions given the facts of this particular case.
I do have one quick follow-up.
Sure.
And I'll try to equalize the time on appellant's side. What specifically in jury instruction 24 was the jury confused about? What are the specific elements? Because doesn't instruction 24 indicate that the jury is not constrained by expert testimony or witness testimony? And perhaps the jury just believed the plaintiff's side and not the defense side. So what about jury instruction 24? What specifically about that instruction caused the jury confusion?
The answer is nobody knows specifically, but the fact is that if it was clear, if the jury wasn't confused by it in any way, shape, or form, then they wouldn't have asked the question that they did.
But so the jury was polled at the end of the case, and each juror indicated that that was their verdict.
That's true. But they weren't asked whether or not there was any confusion as it related to the instruction. And that is the critical question for this particular case. They still, in the court's mind, the district court's mind, they were still confused, even though they affirmed that this was their verdict. They were still confused about whether they could award less than what the plaintiff's counsel requested.
But the defendant did not ask the question of the jury, are you confused or were you confused by the instructions?
That's correct. At the time, we did not, and I don't believe that the failure to do that waives any of the types of arguments that we're presenting here today.
You didn't concede in your answering brief that the argument that they're making on appeal is essentially that a failure to raise this before the jury was discharged forfeits it. You didn't concede in your answering brief that they can make that argument?
What we conceded was that that this issue was preserved for appeal through the Rule 59 motion practice. There's no doubt that it wasn't raised at this particular question about confusion was raised at the time the jury was still present and immediately after having returned its verdict.
So would you say they can make that argument on appeal now that it was untimely for you to raise it late? Are you agreeing with that representation?
No, I don't believe, we don't agree with their position as it relates to the Kramer versus PV case, essentially in terms of preservation.
Okay, so you don't concede as
well.
As
we concede that. When we referenced that in our brief, what we were referring to was that the issue on appeal in front of you all was preserved because there was a dispute under the Rule 59 motion that was made.
Okay.
Not that it was not necessary. That was the preservation. That's where the matter was preserved for you all to be able to review it. There's no doubt about that. That's what we were referring to in our answer brief.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Snyder, I believe you have how many minutes left? 3:39. If you need some additional time, we will grant you up to 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Chief Judge Bulla, though I don't know how much of that will be necessary. First, let me just say that the court can see for itself on their answering brief, page 11, they wrote on the preservation section, Iden does not dispute that Ashley preserved her arguments. So I don't know what else that can mean other than a concession that the waiver issue is very much live in this case. I think I heard Mr. Meyer say that nobody knows how the jury may have been confused in this case, and I think under Justice Young and Justice Marbury's opinions in Leonard and Guy, respectively, that would foreclose any conclusion that the jury was confused because there's no evidence and respondent cannot direct this court to any evidence to suggest that this jury was confused. It seems to me that the respondent wants to say the district court can reweigh the evidence or weigh the sufficiency of the evidence in considering NRCP 59A1E relief. That is false. I think the court was clear in Van Duzer versus Shoshone Coca-Cola Bottling Company in its per curiam opinion that the district court in reviewing this type of motion must view the evidence in a light most favorable to the verdict. It does not allow the district court to independently weigh evidence on its own. Similarly, in Braskia versus Johnson, the per curiam court held that the district court may not substitute its own judgment for the jury's in considering this type of relief. Respondent wants to get up and talk about evidence in the record. Well, I'll submit to this court that the jury heard that same evidence and unanimously rejected it. It is not the place of an appellate court, absent some showing of error under Rule 59, to displace the jury's factual determinations. And I think I also may have heard respondent say that upon this court's questioning that there was evidence that supports the jury's pain and suffering damages verdict. And again, had the district court applied to the correct standard, that would have been dispositive of these issues. I'm happy to be here. I was a Boyd alumni and I actually grew up down the street. So if the court will indulge me, I would just like to say this in closing. In volume 3 of his commentaries, hopefully some of the law students here know about William Blackstone. He argued that the civil jury system was the great glory of the English law because it constitutes the most transcendent privilege that any citizen can enjoy. It secures the just liberties of civil society through the consent of one's neighbors and equals. It enables the impartial administration of justice by reducing involuntary bias and allowing for the consideration and interest and good of the many. It's no wonder that the first Congress ratified the right to a civil jury trial as this nation's Seventh Amendment and that the Nevada founders did so in Article 1, Section 3 of our own Constitution. Here, Ashley demanded a civil jury trial on all her claims. She did not consent to a bench trial on pain and suffering damages. And in usurping the jury's fact-finding province, in sua sponte raising arguments on Iden's behalf, on disregarding each standard governing NRCP 59A1 relief, the district court not only abused its discretion, it cast aside centuries of legal tradition. And this abuse cannot stand. Ashley urges this court to forcefully reverse the district court's order in a published opinion. And in so doing, this court will reaffirm Nevada's longstanding Article 1, Section 3 guarantee that the right of a trial by jury shall be secured to all and remain inviolate forever. And unless this court has further questions, I'll submit.
Thank you very much. Again, counsel, your arguments were excellent, and we appreciate the insights into the issues before us today. We do value your participation in today's arguments. This matter will remain under submission, and this court will issue a decision in the near future. Now that the matters have been submitted, I would invite the students and faculty to feel free to ask questions of the judges or counsel, and I would invite the attorneys who participated in the first oral argument to join us at counsel table. Perhaps we can pull up an extra chair or two. And we would be delighted to take any of your questions as long as they don't deal with the cases that we just argued and have now been submitted. Now my name tag went over.
What's that?
My name tag flew over. No.
If anyone has questions or wants to come up here and speak it, you could put it in this microphone right here.
Okay, so we'll try to take one question at a time. And I see we have a mic up front. Yes. Thank you so
much. We're gonna use the mic over here.
Hi, Charlie. Hello, Chief Judge Bulla and the rest of the court. I wanted to ask, because my peers here are all writing their appellate briefs for the second legal writing class at Boyd Law, what makes a good appellate brief a great appellate brief?
All right, I think I've been tasked with answering this question since I wrote many appellate briefs while I was at the public defender's office. I think what you need to do is you need to tell the story. If you are the appellant, you want to explain why the error that was made in the district court is harmful. Point out what laws, what if there's a statute, if there's a rule, if there is something tangible, if there's a case that was violated at the district court level. Explain how that was, you know, how the law was broken, and then talk about how that error interacted with what happened at trial, what happened in the context of motion practice to make that a harmful error. So, I mean, I guess it kind of depends on what sort of case you have. If it's a trial, really you're looking at, you know, how did the evidence come out? If a piece of evidence shouldn't have come in at trial, explain how it was argued in closing to the detriment of your client, if you're the appellant. If you're the respondent, you are going to want to hammer on the standard of review because as you know, a court of review, we tend to give deference to factual decisions that are made by the district courts. So if there's any possibility that the district court weighed evidence or considered credibility of witnesses in testifying, then as the respondent, you're going to want to hammer home the standard of review and say, hey, the court did what it did. We can't substitute, or, you know, you appellate court cannot substitute your judgment for that of the district court. You really have to kind of think about what side you're on and what it is you're trying to accomplish.
Thank you.
Do any of the attorneys have anything to add to that?
Hi, Jonathan Hilton. I think what makes a good appellate brief great is the revision process. Certainly, the judges should never be the first people to read the briefs. I think it's better to have countless revisions, keep going back. So you can actually bring somebody in, sit, and you can watch them read your brief. You can watch how their face changes. Are they getting it? Are they not? But keep revising until you feel that it is the most persuasive that you can get.
Yeah, that's great advice. So I don't think there's any cookie cutter formula. It's, you know, we think Frank Lloyd Wright said that form follows function. Actually, different architect Sullivan said form follows function. Frank Lloyd Wright said form and function are the same thing. So there are two steps to good legal writing. Know what you're going to say and say it. And most people fail at the first step.
I would also add, especially in appellate briefs, you have to be very honest about what you're arguing and what you're saying is included in the record, because every factual citation has to be supported with a citation to the record, and your case law needs to be accurate. At a State Bar of Nevada convention years ago, or the annual meeting years ago, the Ninth Circuit presented, and they